Hello, welcome to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. In this episode, I'm going to finish up my thoughts about Starship Troopers, and I hope give some general thoughts about some of the works that have you know been influenced by this, and kind of the overall legacy of this. Although I'm not an expert really on it, it's just based on my own experience, I guess, and what I've read and what I've seen. But anyways, if you're just joining us, go to the previous episode if you want to hear my broader thoughts about the philosophy and the discourse surrounding this book in terms of its ideas. And it's also where I discuss the first half of the book. So I think I did the first seven chapters last time, so I'll do the next seven chapters. So chapter eight, we get the epigraph from Proverbs: train up a child the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. So this is the section that has the third history and moral philosophy discussion, the one on crime and punishment, morality, and raising of children, and the comparing of children to dogs. And again, go back to the previous episode for my thoughts on that. I think this is not one of Heinlein's finest moments. If this is truly what he believes, although it's hard to deny that he is kind of preaching in these sections. Heinlein preaches, we know this. He usually is not quite this bad. I guess he gets worse as he goes on in his career in some ways. You got a lot of preaching in Stranger in a Strange Land, ideas I'm more sympathetic with in that book. But then you got a lot of preaching, I think, in pretty much all the later Heinlein novels I've read. So it becomes part of his writing, and you know, you can always say he's just challenging the reader, or he's just presenting an idea, or he's just kind of trolling you with the extreme ideas. I mean, that works to a certain degree, but I think at the end of the day, you know, we have to acknowledge these seem to be what he's thinking that day. But anyways, the epigraph here really fits the theme of this chapter, which is about how, you know, that people are morally neutral, essentially, and they're just a product of conditioning. It's a very Skinner-esque kind of argument being made here. Now, plot-wise, the only thing that really happens here, and again, this is not a book has a lot of plot. It's you know, that's not what it's known for, but the main thing that's happening here in the main story is the Dillinger execution. So Dillinger was a deserter. Now, deserters, as we talked about last time, they usually don't care about them. The military doesn't care because, first of all, they're kind of seen as being, you know, already, there's too many. They don't want all these people to serve. It's a right that all citizens or all civilians have, but it's not something they necessarily want to give everyone. Now, there's regional differences. Some countries seem to have a higher rate of citizenship than others. But the service can't absorb all these people. Right, we have a 10% graduation rate in the text here. I don't know how that compares to other militaries. It seems pretty bad. But that's by design, right? So they just allow deserters to go. If they ever show up again and want to clear their name, they get some kind of administrative punishment, a few lashes, and then they can go back to their civilian lives freely. But this deserter also committed a crime, murdering a baby, it sounds like. Yeah, a baby girl. Okay, so another interesting theme in this chapter, I guess, is this idea that the military take care of its own. It's like their business. Even though he's a deserter, he's still under part of the mobile infantry, and so it's their job. He can't be just given to the regular court system. I don't know how that works in the system in the United States. Like, if you're a soldier and you commit a crime off base, I don't think that's a courts martial, is it? I mean, I'm sure there is a court martial over your behavior, but that's got to be separate than the punishment you might receive from the state, right? I don't know. There might be a various levels of it. But then, of course, like if you commit a federal crime, you know, usually that you're not tried for the same thing at the state level often, right? They usually just pick one, whichever is a stronger case, right? Or whichever one the government decides to do. I guess that's up to the prosecutors or whatever. But the point is, I don't know, but the point here is that it's the military's duty to try and convict and punish its own. And obviously the punishment here is execution by hanging, which was still a fairly common form of execution in the 50s. I think England used that up until I think they're done with capital punishment. It's still done in the Middle East. I think it's how it's done in Southeast Asia too, to a degree, although China uses shootings. We have the lethal injection in the United States. You also had the electric chair in different states. So hanging, not like a weird punishment at the time. It wasn't a total anachronism for Heinlein to pull on that. Also, I think it's got that's how the military's traditionally did stuff. Of course, I guess firing squad by the 20th century, but in the 19th century, still hanging. But anyways, a good chapter overall. The long discussion on raising children and the fact that humans have no natural value or moral guide. I mean, not value, that's a previous chapter, but moral center is something you gotta kind of grapple with if you're gonna read this book. But the final question here we're left with then is, I wonder how Colonel Dubois would have classed Dillinger. Was he a juvenile criminal who merited pity even though you had to get rid of him? Or was he an adult delinquent who deserved nothing but contempt? I didn't know and I would never know. The point of that is there's the claim is made there is no juvenile delinquents. There is just a failure of raising a young person properly, right? Because again, young people, until you hit a certain age, I don't think it's an age here, you get to a certain level of moral maturity, you're not really responsible for your actions any more than a dog that's poorly trained is responsible for biting someone, right? And anyways, I talked about my problems with that idea in the last episode. So then we go to chapter 9. This is here we got Admiral Jonas Ingram, 1926. The quote is, "We've got no place in this outfit for good losers. We want tough hombres who'll go in and win." And that's reflected in a fight at a bar. Again, very cliche. You got soldiers on leave. And they get in this fight at the bar with the civilians. And that's actually seen as sort of a good thing. So not much to say about it. It is sort of something you've seen before. They stick these scenes in a lot of military fiction movies you see, right? Where the soldiers on leave, you know, get in a scuffle with the civilians or something. Not particularly interesting, but what is maybe the reason this is in here is to say, like, it's seen as almost a good thing that these people are willing to stand up for themselves and fight, and that's what you want in a soldier. It's not something to be punished or looked down upon. And then we have the graduation. Out of 2,009 men, 187 graduated. 14 dead, including Dillinger, executed. And his name was not struck, or his name was struck from the regiment entirely, and the rest resigned, dropped, transferred, or medical discharge. It sounds like most of them dropped or resigned at some point. Now, my question is, maybe this is answered in the book, and I just missed it, but if every civilian has a right to join up, it doesn't sound like they have a right to successfully complete their 2-year service and get citizenship. It still has to be earned. So if a civilian joins up, serves 1 year and 350 days, just short of serving the 2 years, but gets dropped, he doesn't get citizenship, right? You have to finish the service to get that. So you don't have a right, you have a right to sign up. You don't have a right to citizenship just by signing up. You have to prove it, you have to earn it, right? I think that goes without saying, but I just said it. But anyways, maybe they can join up again. I don't know. There's no age limit, like his father ends up in the military. Okay, now we're halfway through the book. First 9 chapters constitute about the first half of the book. Now, as I said, like chapter 13 is basically like a little novella. It's the, you know, it's itself is almost like 100 pages, so it's, you know, it's a big chunk of it, but we haven't even got to the war yet. And that's what chapter 10 does. Chapter 10 gets us to the start of the war. And from this point on, the book actually progresses fairly quickly. The quote for chapter 10 is, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots." Thomas Jefferson, 1787. He doesn't do the whole quote here. It's the blood of patriots and tyrants. This Heinlein knows this. Heinlein cuts it off. He puts the ellipses here. He cuts this off on purpose. Is he doing this to obfuscate the whole quote? Because I think that's a very different meaning. To say the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots is very different from saying the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. The difference being the full quote seems to imply a certain a death for a certain cause, a cause that is, like, you know, against tyranny. Not killing a bunch of bugs to support, like, a colonial project. Now, of course, the movie is much clearer on this. The movie makes it very clear that humans are the colonizers. But we get hints here of skirmishes and fighting in the borderlands, out in space, predating even Rico signing up. So the war had a long prelude that we don't get much details on. Right? And I think this book could be a little fatter, a little more world building. Heinlein is pretty good at world building. And I think some of my favorite books are the ones where he does that world building. Here, we spend so much time in the camp, we don't have time then to learn about the bugs, learn about these conflicts, learn about the history. Even the history of the rise of this particular system is kind of glossed over. But anyways, my point on all this is, if we want to read this book a little subversively, we could say, like, Heinlein keeps out that half, knowing the reader is going to know the whole quote and say, ah, you're actually kind of, you are being a bit of a troll here, right? Because you know blood of patriots and tyrants is different than just saying blood of patriots, right? Because if you're just saying blood of patriots, the cause doesn't matter. We're indifferent to the cause. If we're killing bugs in a war of colonial conquest, which kind of is, we get, right, at the end. It's kind of like they go planet by planet by the end of the book, wiping out the bugs, apparently eradicating the entire population of the bugs on those planets, and then settling it, I suppose. And then the final scene is them going to Klondathu. But anyways, we know how the war kind of officially started, and that's with this attack on Rio de Janeiro. Buenos Aires, not Rio de Janeiro, the attack on Buenos Aires, with, like, you know, they just obliterated, destroyed it with, like, an asteroid. And then we get Operation Bughouse, which is a battle of the first battle of Klondathu. So the second battle we don't ever see. It's at the end. So this suggests, too, that Rico survives that battle to write about this, because he talks about the first battle of Klondathu, unless he's writing this while he's on the ship to the first battle or the second battle. But it's a total disaster. It's a total defeat, because it sounds actually kind of stupid. It's like, you know, at the peak of the enemy's power, you just drop on their homeworld. But it's maybe the arrogance of the system, or too much faith in the mobile infantry or whatever, but it's a total failure. Should have been called Operation Madhouse, he writes. Everything went wrong. It had been planned as an all-out move to bring the enemy to the knees, occupy the capital and key points on the home planet, and end the war. Instead, Daenerys lost the war. Now, and we also learn a lot about the bugs here, how they're hard to kill. Now, they have different, like, ranks. They have worker bugs, which don't fight at all. And we have the soldier bugs, the warrior bugs that do fight. And we have, like, the brain bugs. There's a scene in the last chapter where he falls in this pit of worker bugs, and none of them attack him. He's just able to slaughter them, kill them without them ever fighting back. Okay, the soldiers can't surrender. That's where we start. Their workers can't fight, and he wastes a lot of time and animals shooting up workers who wouldn't say boo. And their soldiers' caste can't surrender. But don't make the mistake of thinking that the bugs are just stupid insects, because they look the way they do and don't know how to surrender. Their warriors are smart, skilled, and aggressive, smarter than you, by the only universal rule: if the bug shoots first. You can burn off one leg, two legs, three legs, and he just keeps off coming. Burn off four on one side and he topples over, but keeps on shooting. You have to spot the nerve case and get it, whereupon he'll trot right past you, shoot at nothing until he crashes into a wall or something. So they shoot. They carry guns and they shoot, which is a weird visual if you grew up with the movie. The movie probably is better than this. It looks kind of dorky to have these bugs walking around with rifles. But this implies how they have to be killed. So the way they have to be killed is eventually with gas. So they turn to chemical warfare early in the war as a way of doing this. What else do we learn here in this chapter? We get the first of several units that Rico fights for. He fights in several units that are all named after like their commander. Eventually, it's like Rico's Roughnecks because he's the commander of the battalion or platoon or whatever. But we also get a little hint of the propaganda here. Now, the movie makes a bigger deal of the propaganda than the book does. The book doesn't really, you don't get the sense there's much at all of propaganda, except through the education system, maybe. But here, the calling of this as a strategic victory, when it was a clear defeat, is probably a sign of a certain degree of propaganda taking place in this world. 80% casualty as well. Total disaster, but his unit's so devastated by this that it has to be transferred to a different unit. And he also finds out his mother was killed in Buenos Aires. Really convenient, because that's not, I guess, they're Filipinos. But his father not killed. His father was planning to join her in Buenos Aires, but didn't. They were just on vacation or whatever, on a business trip, and she got flattened in Buenos Aires. So this becomes a motivation for him to keep fighting. But he's already, again, it kind of loses some of the impact because he's already like committed to the mobile infantry by this point. It's pretty important to him. So he didn't need more motivation. It helps with the motivation for his father. But even that is not really the reason we're given in the text. So killing his mother doesn't actually have much role in the plot. Doesn't contribute that much to the story. All right. Chapter 11. The quote here is Winston Churchill, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." Which I think he said during World War II. I can't be sure. I'm pretty sure it was World War II from speech. This is a chapter where we get the first discussion, a very brief discussion in the history and moral philosophy sections on citizenship. Very, very brief from Du Bois' point of view. We're going to get a longer discussion of that later on. This is a chapter that kind of talks about his promotion. Now, this is set. So if you were going to do it chronologically, you'd put chapter 1 after chapter 10, because that's when you have the raid on the Skinnies described in chapter 1, which leads to the Skinnies switching sides. And then that helps them, because through the Skinnies, they get the knowledge they need to develop the gas weapon that doesn't harm humans but kills the bugs. So the strategy really is just to drop these chemical bombs these gas bombs into the tunnel networks of the bugs, genociding them planet by planet, right? I think it's around this point we're told like 1,000 to 1 is a loss for humans. If 1,000 bugs are killed for one human, or is it 1,000,000? No, if we killed 1,000 bugs at the cost of one MI, it was a net victory for the bugs. That is talked about in this chapter. So we learn about that strategy. We also learn about the deeper history of the war partially, which is, again, just hinted at that humans were fighting in space with the bugs earlier over like land disputes, essentially. And we have his promotion. Rico's promoted to go be like a platoon leader or something. Not a real officer, so not even a platoon leader. I forget the rank, but he's promoted somewhat. And he has to like get in a fight with some older soldier who kind of is a little petulant about his command and all that's going on. So there's a little bit about him taking on the burden of leadership. We also learn about Sanctuary, which is really kind of an interesting subplot. I wish there was more about this, because Sanctuary is a Earth-like planet that's it's an Earth-like planet that they're using sort of as a forward base of operations. Like we talked about forward bases and how spaceship will travel. This sanctuary becomes that. It's also like a heavily, it's like most of the economy is military-industrial complex. So it's kind of like the American West in that way, where a huge part of the economy was from just government spending on the military. But it's, we get a little bit of weirdness here when there's the discussion of evolution, because Sanctuary has very little solar radiation. So the cellular mutation rate is very low. What this means is that the indigenous plants are not very hardy. They haven't had to really struggle for survival because of evolution. Now this is, you know, that kind of, that idea of evolution as just being a struggle for survival between species. It's a little, it's not really how it works, in my understanding, but, and you don't need mutations to make for evolution to work, right? Mutations play a role, but I thought it was like more within any population, you have a bell curve, right? And that bell curve will shift. So, one way or another, right? Like, so the giraffe's neck wasn't a mutation. It was just that some giraffes had taller necks in any given population, and then, or ancestors of giraffes, and they would be more likely to survive in a drier climate where the leaves are higher up on the trees or whatever, and then the ones with the shorter necks won't be as likely to survive, right? So it's like more like the bell curve is shifting. I'm sure there's mutations play a role, right? But it's not like a leg pops up, someone is born with a third leg and they can run faster, so they're more likely to survive. I don't think that's how it works. But anyways, that's what we're given here with the mutations. And but what this means is that human plants just dominate the planet. Like, it's terraformed very quickly, very easily, because the native species don't have any chance. Now, the humans living there are then, we're told, won't have that an evolutionary advantage in the future because their descendants won't have the mutations. But we're talking, even if that's the case, even if that's our motor of evolution, is literally mutation, vast majority of which are not beneficial, right, to people. You're talking millions and millions of years. But Heinlein seems to be talking about this in the terms of like a generation or two. Like, people maybe are getting smarter, but it's because we're being better educated, right? We're better fed, right? We're more secure, right, than at other times in history. There's more knowledge. Knowledge is more easily accessed. We have higher literacy rates. That's why IQs are going up. It's not that we're becoming more big-brained. I think we have essentially the same brain we had like 200,000 years ago. I don't know. I'm not the expert. Talk to a biologist. But the Sanctuary stuff is kind of fun and interesting. And there's girls on Sanctuary. So I don't think we get any sex in this book, and we really should. That's why I like the Forever War. But anyways, chapter 12, we have a long quote by John Paul Jones. I think so far every quote's been public domain, so I don't know why the audiobook didn't include these. Maybe just a choice. So this is about responsibility and things like that. So this is, so after he signs up, at the end of chapter 11, he signs up to go career. So he says, I'm going to stay in the military for my whole career, you know, 30 years, 20 years, whatever, till retirement. Probably throughout this whole war. This war sounds like it's going to take a really long time. Even though at the end we get the Battle of Clandanthu, the second battle. So maybe that's the end of the war. But he decides to go, and he gets sent to officer school. A lot of the end of the book involves this transition to officer, what it means to be an officer. And a lot of the history, moral philosophy discussion we have here, it's about citizenship, really, but it's also about like the duties of officers. We get a long explanation of their place in the chain of command when they get their third lieutenant commissions and their duties and the examples of people who failed in their duty. We have an example given of a young officer, a third lieutenant, who has to take over a ship in some historical, like Napoleonic times, and is court-martialed for fleeing battle. And this is upheld generations later because the family was protesting it. Why? Well, it's because your ultimate duty was to follow the orders and fleeing in the face of combat, worst thing you could do, even if you weren't, even if you were accidentally the general. You know, that could foreseeably happen, right? That's the discussion they're going to have with them in, I think it's all in chapter 12. A lot going on in this chapter, though. So we got that whole course in Officer School of Moral Philosophy. We also have him meeting his father. And we learn his father signed up after Buenos Aires was destroyed, not really because of the mother, but really because of, it goes back to why he opposed Rico joining the military in the first place. And he says, it's like, well, I was ashamed that I didn't do this. It was something I feel I should have done, but my family tradition had me not do it. And we had a business. There's a rich family, obviously. So he's very ashamed that he hasn't done this. And that's the real reason he decided to serve during wartime. And then we're also told they're taking older people. So he's in his, like, probably late 40s by this point, right? So that's an interesting, and we got a really emotional moment where he's filled with pride at seeing Rico go on officer school. And then they go their separate ways. And that's kind of the last we hear of his father until, I think, the very end of the story. So then mostly it's the responsibilities of authority, the responsibilities of citizenship, and the responsibilities of officers to be in the chain of command and all this stuff. It's good military science fiction, actually. I think this is a chapter I quite like, even though I, you know, of the ideas we looked at in this book, right? And if you go back to my previous episode where I talk about them kind of one by after another, this is the one I'm probably least offended by, this idea of linking service to citizenship. I just think we can make service compulsory, right? The universal army idea is a little more attractive to me than just a selective one, right? So I urge you to look at this book that hasn't been really discussed much, Frederick Jameson's An American Utopia. It's an interesting book. It has the proposal and then has responses by different writers. Anyways, that's that. Now, chapter 13, our quote is from a Hellenic corporal before the walls of Troy, or attributed. Is it from the Iliad? You guys think this deleted outfit is a blankety-blank nursery? Well, it ain't. See? Well, that's got to be a joke, obviously. But chapter 13, as I suggested before, it's a novella. It's not 100 pages. It's 65 pages in my edition of this book. I have the recent ACE publication. And it basically involves a prolonged operation. So this chapter works quite well as military science fiction. It's the highlight of the book in terms of its military, of being a military science fiction novel, because we get a detailed look at one operation and how units cooperate and how things are done. And we got a few action scenes, but it's an operation to find the brain bugs, right? Or a brain bug on a planet. So they can't just bomb the whole place and kill everyone. They have to actually surgically go in and, you know, use special gas that just knocks out the bugs and do this carefully. And they do. And of course, we find Zim is key in this, although he's not named until the end of the chapter. It's really cool. Zim was the drill instructor that he had when he was trained. So it's a fun chapter. There's not too much to say about it. Just read it and enjoy it. There's nothing that thematic to talk about, except it's in the sense that this is a coming of age story. We see Rico come fully into his own responsibility, courage, leadership. You know, everything has fallen into place, and he helps win the war. The final chapter, chapter 14, is only three pages, and we have four quotes. Am I my brother's keeper? From Genesis. Three are from the Bible, one is from the Quran. Then we got two from Matthew. One says, how think ye, if a man has 100 sheep, one of them has gone astray, doth not leave the 99 and goeth to the mountains and seeking the one that's gone astray? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Same, different part of Matthew. So these are all about no man left behind kind of value. And then we got the Quran, in the name of God, the beneficent and merciful, who saveth the life of one, it shall be as if he had saved the life of all mankind. So same idea. No man left behind here. And this is just the... these quotes don't have that much to do with the chapter. His platoon sergeant is his father. I think that's interesting. This is sometime later, but it's this battle of Clendath, this return, which is, I guess, going to be the final. He's got his own unit, Rico's Roughnecks. And the final words of the book are, "To the everlasting glory of the infantry." Now, we get a historical note, too, about Roger Young, who was a private in World War II, who got the Medal of Honor, attacking a pillbox, destroying it with grenades, and wounded and killed in doing that. And that's, of course, the main... He was on shovel ships, but the main ship that Rico served on was the Roger Young. So it's named after him. So someone that Heinlein seemed to care about or know about or heard about. This is a main theme of Heinlein's throughout his work. We saw it in even some of his stories before, is this bottom-up military appreciation, the day-to-day heroism of the common soldier. And I kind of like that. I think that's something that's really nice about this book and his philosophy overall, that it's not the generals that win the battles. It's the common people. We don't really meet any generals here. Or they're mentioned a few, but that's not where our focus is. And I think that's quite a contribution. So anyways, I'm already a half hour in. So I wanted to talk about legacy. So obviously this is his most famous work, I think, and the one that most people are going to read if they ever read him. It's one that made... He was already fairly well known, and I think his books sold well throughout his life, but this is his one breakout book, I suppose. It's also the end of the juvenile tradition, except for Podkayne, I guess. We still got that, but that's... this was originally written as a juvenile for Scribner, and they didn't want to publish it, and so he ended that relationship, and he went with other publishers from that point on, and didn't completely stop writing fiction for young people, because he did write Podkayne of Mars, but mostly he wrote more serious fiction at this point. I think, his real contribution here is, of course there's been space battles before, all right, but looking at it from the perspective of this common infantryman, right, is something that is maybe now more common, but what I'm thinking of science fiction at the time, not as common, especially not from this kind of grunt perspective, right? I think a lot of there's an episode of Babylon 5 called like Ground Pounders, which is about the infantry. That's just like Star Trek. It's a naval thing, right? It's based on the Navy, and so it is a military science fiction, but naval officers. I mean, the perspective here in this book even is of the Navy thinks that they can win the war on their own, right? And that's what we get in Star Trek, essentially, right? Is there's really no infantry. Sometimes the Starfleet officers will shoot and fight on the ground, but we don't get a sense of, like, a Marine contingent of Starfleet. I think it is there, but it's barely ever used or mentioned, right? But in Babylon 5, again, the perspective is very naval. For obvious reasons, but I think it's a pretty good episode where they're flooded with the infantry, and because the infantry is doing this, what it turns out to be just a suicidal, futile battle where they're all going to be killed. So everyone they meet dies, and it's the one like window we get into it. But the idea that most of the fighting takes place on the ground amongst soldiers is important, and I really like that Heinlein forces us to look that way. I think so much of the imagery of the training, of the muck, of the discipline during training, the harshness of it, the drill instructor, obviously that stuff exists. People knew about that, but this is some of the most memorable stuff. And we see these scenes so often. I've talked about that a few times in this couple episodes. Where, how many times have we seen the recruits get in a fight at the bar? How many times in science fiction or other writing do we see like the drill sergeant with the soldiers lined up and the drill sergeant coming out and yelling at them and berating them, and then by the end of the period they're They're well trained and ready to go. That's the bulk of this book, and we've seen it many, many times. How many times have we seen the young man who wants to join the military, but his father doesn't want him to, but he does it anyways? If you take out the history and moral philosophy stuff, we have a pretty good, military science fiction novel here, I think. Even with it, it's still a good book, but I don't know the origin. I don't have the timeline in my mind of this stuff, but I think this is significant in how other people address these topics, right? Now, the kind of with your shield or on it kind of attitude of the book too, I think is something I rather appreciate. Now, in the 1960s, this book was criticized more for its militarism, right? And Heinlein himself was supportive of American militarism, right? He signed that letter saying, we shouldn't do arms control treaties with the Soviets or whatever, right? And we should continue to invest in weapons of mass destruction. I didn't read that article, but that's what he did. And he was against ending the war in Vietnam and things like this. So he was, in a way, a defender of American militarism, which why I brought up that he doesn't have that whole quote there of Jefferson, where he says, the blood of patriots and tyrants. He forgets the and tyrants part, because that's really a big oversight in a way. It's a very willful oversight. It was done on purpose. And the cause of what you're fighting has to matter, right? And people in the 60s with the anti-Vietnam War protests started to ask that question, right? And the book that comes out of this is one I may talk about at some point. I certainly recommend you read about it. Is The Forever War. I'm not going to talk about every single book that's been influenced, because there's many copiers of Heinlein around, right? But the one I know best is Halderman's The Forever War, which I believe he wrote while he was in 1974, while he was in university or while he was in graduate school or something. And a couple big differences here. One is, you still got the armored suits. I love that. That's another imagery we get here, like the Fallout power armor. Comes from this. It's used in the Forever War. It's not used in the movie version of this, probably because of costs associated. But if they made that movie now, you'd probably get the full power armor. Also, you don't see their faces, right? The character's face. But it works for Iron Man. You don't need to see Iron Man's face, because you know who's behind the mask. There's only one of them. But if you have 1,000 guys in power armor, you can't tell your characters apart. But the Forever War, so I think Halderman was in the Vietnam War. That's my understanding. Let me double check. Yeah, I had to look this up. So he was actually wounded in combat, combat wound in the Vietnam War after being drafted. Heinlein, remember Heinlein's war experience, right? He couldn't serve in the Navy because of his eyesight and other problems, I think. So he basically was in a think tank making ray guns or imagining what a ray gun might look like. Didn't help much to the war effort. And I think he's bothered by that. Maybe in the way Lovecraft was bothered by the fact that he didn't fight in World War I. If you're actually one of these grunts he's talking about, you can praise Roger Young all you want and honor him. Not a bad thing to do, I suppose. But would he look back at if he had survived? Or let's say this doesn't happen to him and he just is a normal grunt and no less brave, no less courageous, but the events that led to his death didn't happen. Maybe he's going to write an anti-war book if he ever becomes a writer. Halderman did anyways, called The Forever War. And it reads a lot like this book, but it does things so much better. It's just a superior book in almost every way, I think. Not only because it's anti-war. It's called The Forever War in part because he incorporates the time dilation issue with with FTL. So they go faster than the speed of light to fight this war, something Heinlein doesn't care about really discussing here. But that means time's going slower for you than back at Earth. So in Earth, you get long stretches of time. So he lives for like thousands of years because he's fighting this war. And the war goes on for thousands of years. We find out that the reason it's going on is it's just basically economic stimulus. It's the military-industrial complex. It's just sustaining the economy. But he gets to see the big changes on Earth. And that's wonderful. That's really a good part of the Forever War, is the changes on Earth. But this idea of a war never ending, these interstellar wars being something that really can't end, is such a wonderful reflection on the Vietnam War experience, I think. So I really do urge you to read The Forever War alongside this, if you want. And then the movie, so let me wrap up this episode and talk about the movie, of course. The movie by Paul Verhoeven is the director. Apparently, he never even finished the book. He didn't like it, which is pretty apparent. I mean, we have some scenes from it, like the history and moral philosophy stuff is reduced to one scene here. And we got the training, and we have most of the movie, though, is the fighting. So it's kind of flipped in that way. Most of the book is the training and the background. And we don't get anything about the officer training, Rico's promotion, really. I think he gets a field promotion in the movie. But I think the important thing about the movie is, although the book, that's politics, are either Heinlein's or close to being Heinlein's. I think you can't argue that he's just trolling you. These seem to be Heinlein's politics. He is preaching to us. The movie is I'm talking about the 1997 movie, of course, and not one of the sequels, is openly like anti-fascist. It looks at this society and is critical, right? For instance, the guy in the book, there's a fake guy with no legs, or there's a guy with no legs, but it's fake to scare off recruits. Here, every adult is injured in some way, right? Scarred face, their teachers, their recruiters, everyone is like one arm, two legs, scarred, damaged in some way. The constant sense that war has a cost is constantly there. And that is, and then along that you have the constant propaganda. Now Verhoeven, of course, used like ads this way in RoboCop as well. And in this movie, the ads reinforce this idea that this population is totally propagandized and totally like brainwashed by the state. Again, that's not what we get in the book. And in fact, I think the movie here is a little more simplistic. I think the way citizenship works here in the book is actually kind of interesting because this system seems to work. Whether it would or not, I don't want to speculate on, but it works without endless TV commercials telling you to support this, support the state, recruit, sign up, kill the bugs in your neighborhood, that kind of stuff. Doing your part, it doesn't need that, right? Rico's father signs up out of a moral duty that has been in him, but we don't get the propaganda. Maybe it exists. I said there's a couple of hints that there is, like calling the first battle of Klondathu a strategic victory or something, when it wasn't. But I think the movie is a little more blatant. Now here also something implied here is the gender equality. I think Carmen Sita's character is inflated a lot in the movie in a good way, because this book is missing women. I like that they have they don't have gender segregation in the units, that they're showering together, that R&R clearly involves sex, and that's encouraged among the troops as camaraderie building. I think that's interesting additions to the text. It's not just, I know Verhoeven too likes putting that into his movies, but I think it works really well here. It's not gratuitous or excessive, it actually has a certain role. And then, of course, we have the fascist imagery throughout the movie. Doogie Howser's character, he's the officer, right? The psychic officer. We don't have psychics here, but the movie adds them. He's like an intelligence officer, and he's basically dressed like, in the full Hugo Boss getup, right? And you're not supposed to see that and say, these are good guys. You're supposed to see that they're bad. And I think the main thing is something that maybe is implied in the book subtly, but is made explicit here, is that humans are the intrusive settler colonial society. Like these, I think they're, are they Quakers or Mormons? Maybe they're Mormons. That settle a planet. Now, this is very much like the Star Trek episode Arena, too, same plot. But Arena comes first. That's the one where Kirk fights the Gorn. But the whole plot there is the Federation and the Gorn fighting over a planet where the Federation seems to have been the intruder. Right? And then you have the fight as a way for this other alien to mediate. Here we have the humans clearly intervening on bug land, bug planets, and they start the war, right? So the film is obviously satirizing fascism in a way the book isn't. And the book is, again, you have to squint or deny something or just decide to believe that Heinlein doesn't believe these things. But it's an act of will on your part to do that, I think. That said, I think very important book, worth spending a couple episodes on. I kind of wish I prepared a little bit more. I just didn't have time to watch all the sequels, for instance, or read every book that's influenced by Starship Troopers. But I think the point's clear that this has had a big influence on our culture, not just in science fiction writing, but generally. Our image of what space war is changed, right? And I think the use of the infantry, putting the infantry centerpiece, making them the centerpiece in armed conflict in space is important. Even Heinlein didn't do this much in his earlier work. When he did have space battles before, they tended to be like just shooting at each other, right? Ships shooting at each other. So important contribution. It's also going to be, for Heinlein, I think, the end of an era. I haven't read Podkayne yet, so I'll have to see what that's involved with. But when you read the next book by Heinlein, Starship, Stranger in a Strange Land, it's like totally different. And that is going to be a different stage in his career. I put this book too because I do think, I broke off at the juveniles in my mind as I was planning out this podcast. I didn't break this one up into seasons like I did the Lovecraft series, but there was kind of a break after the last episode, or after Half Spaceship Will Travel. Where do you put Starship Troopers? Do you put it as a coda to the juveniles, or do you put it at the beginning of a new phase? I'm putting it at the beginning of a new phase where he's kind of really grappling with big philosophical ideas. And I think that's going to continue, and I like that. Some people don't. Some people think Heinlein gets really weird after this point in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I'm sure that's true to a degree, but I'm eager to swallow that stuff and find out my thoughts on it. I've read a handful of the books, and the ones I do know come later I did like. So three of them. I've read I'll Fear No Evil, Stranger in a Strange Land, and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. The rest I haven't even opened yet. So super excited to get into them because I know they're almost all controversial in some ways. So that's it. That's going to end my coverage of Starship Troopers. So it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it. So, and overall, I kind of mapped it out. I think there's going to be about 30 episodes left in this entire run until I'm done with Heinlein. So we're coming to the end. Thank you for bearing with me through all these episodes. And I really hope you got something out of this and appreciate it. I certainly am. So thanks for listening. And let me know what you think of Starship Troopers. If you have more to say about the legacy of this book, I'd love to hear it because that's something I would like to share with others in a future episode if you have anything to add to that. I know I was just scratching the surface. Anyways, see you next time. Thanks for listening.